now we're going to abandon her up here.
Yeah, that's quite all right. I am Linda Smith, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. It's such a privilege to be here. Thank you, Luann. That was so sweet. I told her not to tell the truth. So, so I guess she did what I said. I do appreciate Jerry and Jeanette and the committee asking me to come back again. I love this weekend. I just can't get here every year. But I do appreciate it. It's a privilege and an honor to be asked. And to see so, I know a lot of people. That's great. And to see all of you and to make some new acquaintances this weekend. I always like to start by saying what a grateful member of Al-Anon I am. And I know that I have not always been grateful through my life, but I can say today that I am grateful. I heard that gratitude is love in action, and it reminded me of something my husband used to say. I'd say, I love you, I love you. And he said, why don't you show me? He didn't want me to just say it. He wanted me to do all these things for him and do this, do that, you know. So gratitude is love in action. So I'm trying to show my gratitude by sharing a little bit with you this afternoon. And Luann knew I needed a meeting, so she took me out to an Al-Anon meeting this morning. So maybe that'll help me a little bit, get me going here. But I am grateful, like I said, to be with you once again. I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a home with a mother, father, sisters, grandmother. We went to church every Sunday. The only thing wrong with that family was I was in it. I was the kind of child that if you didn't do what I wanted to do and play with me like I wanted to play, I just wouldn't play with you. Just had to always be my way. I was taught in that church, and as I was growing up, I was taught to pray, "Thy will be done." And I prayed that way, but I didn't mean a word of it. I was telling God what I wanted and how to do it, and I thought that's how it ought to be done. Anyway, I grew up, like I said, and went off to school, and I was popular in high school, and I was always loud and vivacious, and I guess that's how I pushed my way through everything that I did through the years. So I was pretty popular. I was from the era, though, that it was girls. Nice girls didn't smoke and drink and do those kind of things. So I didn't run with that crowd. I was with the good little girls. And then I got off to college, and I decided to try it all. And you know, I found out, though, after I got in this fellowship, that alcohol did not do for me what it does for an alcoholic. Because I always felt like that I was in control. And then when I drank, I felt like I was losing control. I've heard the alcoholics say the opposite. But I couldn't lose control because I always had to be in control and make sure that you were doing what you were supposed to do, whether it was the alcoholic in my life or anybody else, because I could manage better than anybody is what I thought all my life. But anyway, I grew up, and I did get through school, and I met this guy that drank. Well, by then it had become acceptable, you know. And we started dating. And we dated, and we dated, and we dated. See, I had this thing in my head as I grew up that he was going to get down on his knees and propose to me, and we were going to get married, have two children, little white house with a picket fence, and live happily ever after. Well, we dated 7 years, and he just didn't, you know, he never did learn how to play his part. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, but he just didn't get it. So finally one day I said, I think it's time we got married. And he said, okay, so we got married. Well, by this time I knew that the drinking was a problem. I still knew nothing about alcoholism. I don't even know if I'd heard the word alcoholic. I mean, I didn't have a clue. But he loved me so much, I thought, that when we got married, he'd quit drinking. Because he had already gotten in trouble with the law before I married him. He had lost his license. I had to do all the driving. Of course, I know today I'd have done all the driving anyway because I could do it better than anybody else. So, excuse me, we got married. And I thought, like I said, that he would quit. Well, the drinking increased rapidly. And the more he drank, the more I decided it was my job because I had chosen him. And I had to make him quit. That was my life's work. So I did everything I could think of to do. I poured out his liquor, but I didn't want him to get another DUI, so I'd go get it for him, bring it back. And that didn't make a lot of sense then, but I just thought that's the way to do it. And I would take his bottles and I'd pour it out and put some other stuff in there so he wouldn't, or even dilute it so he wouldn't get as drunk. I thought I could control it. And he convinced me one time he could just drink beer. And I didn't know any better. I thought, okay. And I couldn't figure out why he was getting so drunk all the time. And I got to hunting the bottles. And I found them everywhere. He was drinking his beer in front of me. The whole refrigerator was full of beer. But his liquor he had hid. So I'd find the liquor and I'd pour it out and then I'd buy him more. Anyway, there was nothing wrong with me when I got here. Absolutely. I could have told you that. I came to Al-Anon and y'all made me sick. I came to Al-Anon and found out how sick I was. But that's what I used to say. Anyway, y'all excuse me. I've been sick and I'm hoarse. And I know, I just hate it. I hate that I sound like I do. But anyway. So we had been married about a year and a half, and his sister was in a hospital in another town, and she had a 2-year-old son, and I kept the little boy a lot for her because she was sick. So one Saturday, I decided that we needed to go see her. So I took the little 2-year-old, my husband, and he always took an ice chest full of beer and his guns. He always hunted and fished, and he had all that stuff. So he's in the back seat. This is in the 70s, and the little boy's in the front seat, and we're going to this town early that morning, and my husband's fine. He's in the back seat. He cleans his guns, reloads them. He drinks his beer, and he's in pretty good shape. We get there and go in to visit his sister. Well, he got away from me. See, I was already into playing these games. I kept up with him all the time. I had to keep the keys away from him where he wouldn't get another DUI, and so I was into playing these games, but somehow I had to tend to the sister that was sick, the little 2-year-old. So my husband left, took the car, got the keys. But he came back. And when he came back, I knew that he had been had something else besides beer to drink. And so it got time to leave, and we were going. And I had not fed the 2-year-old, so we stopped at this hamburger place. And my husband said, "Let me just stay in the car. I'm just so upset." Well, at that point, I really didn't know he had bought something else to drink. But I had a slip. I left him in the car with car keys and the liquor. And I took the 2-year-old in, and we're sitting there eating because I was feeding him inside, and I looked out the windows, and my husband was leaving. I left the 2-year-old sitting there, and I ran out before he pulled out in the traffic, somehow got the car turned off, got him out of the front seat in the back, ran back in and got the 2-year-old. And got in the car and headed out. Well, I had seen my husband drunk a lot, but I had never seen him quite like he was that day. It was almost as if he didn't know who I was or what was going on. So we're heading out of that big town, and I'm driving. My husband's in the back seat. The little 2-year-old's up here. And I'm trying to tell my husband. I'm reaching back there trying to tell him everything will be okay, because, see, I can handle it. I can handle anything, I thought. He grabs my arm, and I'm trying to drive, you know, and I finally get my arm back. We're headed on out of town. And he said, "Pull over at that liquor store." I said, "I can't. I've got to get this baby home." And he pulled a loaded gun on me. He said, I said, "Stop." I pulled over. Now, I had some just normal fears, but nothing, no abuse, nothing like that in my life, no real fear until that moment. And I was scared to death. I was praying, and I was talking for my life because I didn't know what he would do. About that time, some friends had also been to see his sister, and they saw our car and thought we had broken down. You might have a different speaker, but when they stopped, he threw the gun down, of course, and didn't kill me. And we got home that night. Actually, that couple that I didn't know very well, she took the little boy, and her husband, who I didn't hardly know at all, got in the car with me. I kept thinking, how am I going to tell him he may die before the day's over? But anyway, finally my husband passed out in the back seat, and we got home. Now, like I said, I had never had that kind of fear in my life, and I had never been a person to stuff fear, stuff anything down. If I thought it, it came out, you know. But he passed out finally, went to sleep. I got the little two-year-old to sleep when we got home, and I laid awake all night, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? Hadn't been in that. I'd waited 7 years to get in that marriage, and I hadn't been in it about a year and a half. And I thought divorce just wasn't an option at that point to me because I wasn't raised, you know, thinking I could get a divorce. So I thought, okay, what can I do? And I thought, okay, I got to redouble my efforts. I really got to make him quit drinking. So the next morning when he got up, I told him in detail what he did. And I know today that he was in a blackout. He did not remember anything that had happened. But I didn't know anything about that, so I stuffed it, all that fear down inside and wouldn't talk about it, wouldn't tell anybody. And we go along, and I'm working harder and harder at making him stop now because he's got to stop because I'm scared now. I'm really scared. So we're going along, and in 1977, now I'm going to tell my age, in 1977, this preacher that I would go talk to knew a little bit about alcoholism and treatment centers. And I was talking to him, and he suggested that he go to treatment. So we talked my husband into going to treatment in 1977. I put him in treatment, and I thought, this is wonderful. I needed a break. And he was up there. I left him, you know, at the treatment center. And I was at home, and I thought, okay, you know, this is going to be great. Well, they told me to go to Al-Anon, and I had never heard of that. But I was going to be a good wife and do what they said. So I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting in 1977. I got his mom to go with me in this little neighboring town. There was a speaker, and she was funny. I thought it was great. I got some pamphlets, you know, and I read a little bit about it, and I thought alcoholic sounded okay. It sounded better than a sorry drunk. So, and anyway, he's gone for the cure. He's gone for the cure. In my mind, I thought he's going to come home to that treatment center. We're going to have those two children. We're going to get that little white house with picket fence. We're going to live happily ever after. So it got time for me to go to the treatment center. And I went, and we were young still, and he had cleaned up good. And, it was nice. Honeymoon was good. And everything's great. They take me to my first AA meeting while I'm at the treatment center. And it's back then, and everybody smoked, you know, it, and me too. And it was just, but I fell in love with alcoholics that night at that AA meeting. So anyway, we were at the treatment center, and, you know, I thought he'd gone for the cure. I didn't know till I got to Al-Anon about the three C's. They said I didn't cause it, I couldn't control it, and I couldn't cure it. I didn't know there wasn't a cure. And I sure thought I caused it, but by that time, we played the game of blame. He blamed me for everything, and I blamed him for everything. And he said it was my fault he drank. And after being told that after year after year after year, I began to believe it. But anyway, they told me, Al-Anon, it wasn't my fault. And also, they told me that I couldn't control it. Of course, I didn't buy into that. I still had some things I hadn't tried. But anyway, but I couldn't cure it. But anyway, I really thought that he had gone for the cure. So it got time, like I said, for me to go, and got time for us to go home. And I thought, it's going to be wonderful, you know. He had an AA contact. We get home, and he got drunk that night. He never called his AA contact. Well, the seed had been planted, but I never thought that Al-Anon or AA was what we needed. From 1977 to 1984, I still had to get sicker, and I still had to try all of those things, thinking that I could control it. And so, like I said, we got sicker and sicker for years and years, and not even thought once about AA or Al-Anon as a solution to our problem. So we continued to get sicker and sicker, and I tried everything. I took him to the psychiatrist. I told the psychiatrist everything was wrong with him. There was never anything wrong with me. One time, I was taking him on an outpatient basis to this psychiatrist out of town. I had the insurance. I worked. You know, I took him to this psychiatrist, and I had to sit out in the waiting room, and he'd go in and talk. Well, he drank his beer going up there, and he drank his beer going back, whatever. Well, one day I wanted to see that psychiatrist. I thought, I'm wasting my time and money. He's not helping him a bit. He's still drinking. And I finally, they weren't going to let me in to see him. But of course, I pitched one of my little fits, and they let me in to see him. And he had convinced that psychiatrist that I was the one with the problem. He didn't go back to him. I wasn't about to waste my money anymore. Anyway, I did a lot of things, you know, all through those years, trying to, thinking that I could get him sober, that it was my responsibility, not knowing any better. Well, anyway, so we continued to get sicker. In 1984, his mom came to me and said, we got to get him some help. I said, I'm not putting him anywhere, because, see, one time one of those psych units that I'd put him in, he came out and he looked at me and he said, if you ever try to put me anywhere else, I'll kill you. He wasn't a violent person, but that fear that I'd pushed down inside after he held that gun on me, it came back. I thought, I can't do anything. So when his mom told me that they wanted to get him some help, I said, I can't do anything. I can't put him anywhere. She said, well, will you agree to talk to him with us? And we thought it was just all psychiatric problems, and so we were going to put him under this great psychiatrist we had heard about, you know, and get all his problems solved so he could quit drinking. So I agreed with him to meet with him, and so we decided to put him in treatment under a psychiatrist. But we couldn't take him to the next morning. Well, I know now any good alcoholic would do what he did. He knew, he wasn't stupid. He knew he was going off. We just convinced him to go talk to him, but we had his bag packed. We were going to leave him. And so he did what any good alcoholic would do that night after his parents left the house. He went and got drunk. Well, I sat there, and I had built walls up. We were talking about that in Al-Anon meeting today. It hurt so badly to feel that I didn't want to feel anything anymore, so I was just like a zombie. But I couldn't laugh and have fun either, but I didn't cry a lot anymore. I'd gotten to that point, I'd just functioning, because I'd built those walls up. So all of a sudden, I thought about taking him for that to that psychiatrist and leaving him at that treatment center. And I thought, I can't do this. And the floodgates opened, I just started crying. And those walls started tumbling. Even at that point, I was scared to death, because I knew that if I took him, he would take his beer and he would take his guns, and it would be a repeat of what we had done before. So I was scared to death. I called the preacher that had helped us in 77. He said, I've got a funeral. I can't go with you. He said, but don't go by yourself. Get his parents to go with you. So I called his mom, and I finally convinced her to go. And, of course, she went with me to take him. He didn't take his guns. He didn't take his beer, because Mama was there. So I took him, put him in treatment now. Well, actually under a psychiatrist at this treatment center. And told the psychiatrist all his problems. Barely mentioned the drinking. Told him all these other problems. Well, they called me after a while, and they said, we've discovered that your husband is an alcoholic, and we've got two separate units, so we're going to move him out of the psych unit into the alcohol and drug unit. And I thought, well, I knew that. But I didn't. So anyway, they moved him, and he finished his treatment there, and it got time for me to go get him. And I went back, and I had no hope. I had no hope that he would stay sober. By this time, I had no hope at all. I've just... good wife, I was just staying with him because that's what I was supposed to do. So I go up there and go through a couple of days, whatever. We come home. This time, while he was in there, though, the counselor called and asked me, said, are you willing to tell him, if he doesn't do something about his drinking, that you won't be there when he gets back? Well, see, that's the one thing I had not tried. I tried everything I could think of, but I never left him. I threatened a lot, but I never left him. And I knew that I couldn't go on like that. So I was able to tell him and mean it. I learned in Al-Anon to say what you mean and mean what you say. And then they told me you don't have to say it mean. But anyway, but I did learn it. So I had told him that while he was in treatment. So when we got home from the treatment center, he called his AA contact, and this man came to get us, to take us to our first meeting that night. And this was June of that 1984, and I'm grateful to say I have never left the doors of Al-Anon since. I've needed it and still need it. But anyway, so we start on our journey, and I'm First couple of, I live in a little bitty town, so the first meetings I went to, there was no Al-Anon the first few nights, because there was like one Al-Anon, still is, only one Al-Anon week, a week, meeting a week. And so it was AA, open AA, and I'd go with him. We'd sit there in that meeting, and they'd say something I thought he ought to hear. I'd punch him. I want to make sure he heard it. I actually read the big book for him and underlined it in yellow highlight. I still have that book. And I told him what he needed to know. I wasn't sick. I could have told you when I came down, and I was not sick. I was one of the sickest. But anyway, so this was going on, and one night we're sitting there drinking coffee before the meeting, and it was the night that Al-Anon met in the next room, you know. So this older woman, that her husband was the one that took us to some of the meetings at first, she said, you know, you're supposed to be in this other meeting. I said, well, how dare she? I went to Al-Anon in 1977. I knew that. So I went into Al-Anon, like I said, in June of 84. And I went in, and she sold me the book, One Day at a Time, which is one of our daily readers. And I started going to Al-Anon and Open AA on a regular daily basis. He was to make 90 meetings in 90 days. But one day he came in, and I looked at his eyes across the room, and I knew he'd been drinking. I didn't even have to get close enough to kiss him to smell it, because I just could tell. Well, I hadn't been in Al-Anon a month or so, but I think this is how good this program works. Not me, but the program. I did not want to do what I had always done, and I thank God for that today. So I went back in the bedroom. I didn't say anything to him. I went back in the bedroom, and I got my little One Day at a Time book, and in the back it has an index, and I read about slips. It talks about the alcoholic slips, but it talks about our slips too. And I came back in the room, and I said, because he was trying to hide it, and I said, I know you've been drinking, but I can't do anything about it. Now, at the time, I didn't know what a big step that was. I didn't know I finally could admit I was powerless over alcohol, you know. But it was one of the biggest steps I've ever taken in this program. And so I continued to go to meetings. Open AA and Al-Anon meetings. Sometimes he went, sometimes he didn't, with me. But I continued to hear, and there was a page in the book that talked about hope. And I heard him talking about hope. Well, my only hope was that he'd stay sober. I was so focused on the alcoholic that one of the things they said over and over and over to me in Al-Anon was take the focus off the alcoholic and put it on yourself. And if I hadn't done that, I would still be just as sick as I was when I walked in 84, because I couldn't get better because I was living my life through him, and what he did was all I could see. But I slowly began to take the focus off of him, and thank God for that, because he never did get sober. He died eventually from this disease, and he never could get sober. But anyway, there was hope for me. And finally, I saw in that page that it didn't just mean hope that he would stay sober, that there's hope for us regardless of whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And I'm so grateful for that. Well, anyway, like I said, we were going along, still going to meetings. I'm going to meetings. And I got scared again because the guns came back into play. He was still drinking, and we lived on their farm, and we lived in a mobile home at that time. And my husband would see things I didn't see. I don't know if any of y'all did that. We're sitting there one night, and he's got his pistol and in the trailer. Now, inside, he said, you see that snake over there? And I said, no, and he just shoots. Very irrational behavior. And he did crazy things. He shot a little dog in front of me, and he loved dogs. But, I mean, he just did things crazy, you know. Anyway, I got scared again. I just got scared. I learned more about alcoholism, and I learned that you know, how irrational his thinking was. So after being in Al-Anon for over six months, I decided that I just couldn't stay there. I didn't intend a divorce. Now, I hadn't left him before. I hadn't tried this. But I just couldn't, really and truly, could not stay there any longer. So, and then we lived on their farm, and we had no kids. So I decided that I would leave. So I did. And I moved, and at first I didn't tell him where I was going because I was scared. Eventually I did, and I stayed separated for a long time, and I kept going to meetings and started working on me, really working on me, and I was on my knees praying and asking God for his will to be done in my life. And for the first time in my life, it was the first time I'd ever meant it when I said it. I was taught to say it as a child, but I never meant it. But I really didn't want to run the show anymore. Not all the time. I had to let go a little bit of time. But anyway, but I really was serious, and I didn't know what to do about that marriage. I stayed separated, but I just knew I couldn't live in active alcoholism anymore. And I didn't think divorce was right. Nobody in my family had ever gotten a divorce. So it took me a while so that I could be okay and have it okay between me and God before I could do anything about it. And this is an honest program, and I have to get honest to say that out there in those AA meetings, there was this good-looking man. Oh, my gosh. And he was chasing me. And I didn't think it was right to date still married, even though I was separated. So I decided finally to get a divorce. So I did. And my husband didn't want it. I went to him to get him to sign the papers. We didn't have anything together, so it was just a simple divorce. And he said that he would, but he didn't want to. But he wanted me to be happy. He wanted me to have the best, you know, all that. And he cried. He cried a lot. And I just wanted to say, sign it and let me go. I mean, I was at that point at that time. But anyway, so I got the divorce, and God did for me what I could not do for myself. The man that was chasing me quit chasing me, so I started chasing him. Don't tell me I can't have something. And so I started going after him, but God did for me what I could not do for myself because I didn't get him. I said to my sponsor one time, and I have had good sponsorship from the time I started. That old lady that told me to get an Al-Anon that night, she became my sponsor. And I was complaining about this guy in AA, this and that and the other needed fixing, you know. And she said, Linda, what are you thinking going to do? You think you can change him? I said, oh, no. See, I'd learned just enough to know I couldn't change somebody else. I said, I just think I'll be a good influence on him. She said, you better look at that. I needed to look at what I was doing because I was doing the same thing. I was hunting somebody to fix, you know. But anyway, like I said, I didn't get in that relationship. So I'm in Al-Anon. I'm working the steps. I'm looking at myself. I'm doing my fourth step. My sponsor has me go through that. The old blueprint for progress that we had in Al-Anon, I used it and some other things that I was given. And I was just amazed to find out that I had a character defect called controlling. I didn't even know I was a controlling person. I'd been a controlling person since I was a child, and I had no idea. And I went to my sponsor when I did the fifth step, and I said, I didn't know I was like that. She said, Linda, you did the best you could with what you had. But you know better now. So I can't get away with it anymore. But anyway, I found out a lot of other things. But that was one of the character defects that I had the most trouble with. And still do today. I have to be very careful. I've learned there's a lot of difference in leadership and control. And service work certainly helped with that through the years, too. Anyway, so I'm going along. And like I said, I had prayed and turned my will and my life over to God and learned to pray a different way. And worked the steps, you know, and was really beginning to see a little hope at the end of the line. Anyway, I'm getting better, and my sponsor and her husband starts taking me to these AA weekends and Al-Anon weekends and to area assembly, and I'm meeting people. Well, they introduced me to a friend of theirs at a Serenity weekend at Jekyll Island, and I had probably been divorced by now about a year when I met him. And at first, there was just we just became friends. He was older than me, and he had a good personality, and I liked to be around him, and we just became friends. We'd see each other at different assemblies. That's when we all met at one place years and years ago. And we would see each other at different weekends. And, you know, but I was trying, I was about to quit chasing that other one by then. But I was dating some earth people. Y'all know what that is? That's those that aren't in here, AA or Al-Anon. They were boring, very boring. I just love alcoholics. But anyway, so this sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that they had introduced me to and we'd become friends, his name was Rip, R-I-P. And finally, one day, he asked me, could he come see me? He lived in Waycross and I lived in Fitzgerald, which was 70-something miles. And I didn't have anybody dating. I wasn't dating anybody at that time. And I said, well, I guess so. And he came and we started dating. Well, I was all right till he touched me. Then my friendship became more. Telling myself. Anyway, we still remained friends, but we started dating, and within 6 months we were married, and I moved to Waycross. And the good thing we had in that marriage is that we stayed friends through the whole marriage. He was very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the time you're talking about when we were here and I was dancing with him, he spoke. And I don't know what year, it was in the 90s, early 90s, but that was my first time to come to Altoona, and I was with him, and we were married, and he was a speaker here. And he always liked to introduce me. He was older than me, and he'd have me stand up. My hair was long back then, and he'd just brag about what he'd say, old drunk, look how good he'd done, you know, make me stand up. I was a lot younger then. Anyway, so we're going along. We got married, and, you know, everything's going good. I get into really involved in service work, and I'm working the steps, and life is good. I was 40 years old when we married. I'd never had those children in that first marriage that I wanted, nor the little white house and picket fence. So when I married Rip, he had two children in their 20s, and I wanted children, and he knew it. So he said, why don't we leave it in God's hands? So I got pregnant on the honeymoon, and I lost that baby before I even knew I was expecting. So I worked real hard, and it was fun for 2 years. And when I was 42, I got pregnant again. And I was really excited, but by then Rip was not very excited because he had lost his job at the – well, he didn't lose his job. He had gotten hurt at the railroad, and he couldn't work anymore. And – He was older, and we were starting out again, you know, and I was going to have a child at 42 years old. So I carried that child 3 months, and I lost that baby, and I was just devastated. I would have told you at that point that I had a good conscious contact with God. I was working this program. I was sponsoring an Alteen group. I was in service work. Rip and I had begun to speak. We were going places together, and life was good. But when I lost that baby, I lost my dream too. Not only mourning the child, but I lost the dream of what I thought life should be. And my program just went out the door. Now, the two things I did right, I kept going to meetings, and I kept calling my sponsor. But I didn't like anybody. Nothing was right. I didn't know what all was wrong except that I was just angry. And one night, Rip said, Linda, have you ever thought about that you might be angry with God? I thought, no, not me. I could never be angry with God. I could be angry with you and everybody else. And then in the next breath, I thought, why did God let me get pregnant if he was going to take my baby? And I realized that I was angry with God. And I had to work through that and thank God for the program. And what happened working this program is that I found out that I was not angry. I mean, that I didn't have to be angry with God, that God had given me so much more. I didn't have the dream that I had dreamed, but I was sponsoring a lot of girls in the program. I had a great husband. I had a great family. I mean, things were great. I had to turn it around in my mind and realize, see, and how I did that, I started praying differently. I started thanking God for what I had instead of crying over what I didn't have. And I started healing. And I started getting better. And then, like I said, Rip and I got to going more and more and more and speaking. And life's good. We bought a house. It wasn't white. Didn't have a picket fence. But I got my house finally. And so things are going great. I'm working hard at trying to get back that. And I even have now a closer relationship with God than I had before that. You know, it had grown. And everything's going great until 1995. And my world fell apart. My rib was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I thought, oh my, I can't go through this. But you know, because of what I had gone through before, I didn't have to go there and be angry with God. I turned to God to get me through that. My husband lived 6 months from the time he was diagnosed, and he handled it so beautifully. I would say, I didn't want to pray for God's will anymore, because God's will might be that he die, and I didn't want him to die. And I had the hardest time praying for God's will. And I'd say something. I said, "Oh, Rip, we gotta pray for your healing. God healed you one time. You're a miracle. You're sober, and so we gotta pray for healing." And he'd say, "Linda, it'll be okay." Y'all know how he talked. Said, "It'll be okay. Just pray for God's will. Whatever happens, it'll be okay." People would come by the house constantly. There was just a steady flow of AA and Al-Anon friends from everywhere through those 6 months, and they'd say, "Well, I don't understand, Rip. Why you?" He'd say, "Why not me? Why not me?" One of his AA friends said that he showed us how to live this program, and now he's showing us how to die. And he did, and that helped me get through it too. But now I don't get through things as easily. I have to fight and scratch and claw at everything I do. But anyway, so as we go along, and he's getting weaker and weaker, we're still able to go to some things and do what we have to do. And it was probably a month before he died. One of his AA friends came to sit with him at the house, and I got out and had to do some things and got off by myself, and I started praying, and I said, "God, help me to accept your will in this, whatever it is. I can't do it by myself." So in January 1996, my sweet Rip died in my arms in our bed, and they had told me that it could be awful, gasping for breath or whatever, but it was very, very peaceful. And you know, I had the opportunity to tell him, which I had always told him how much I loved him and sometimes showed him, but anyway, I had the opportunity when he was dying to talk to him about dying, and I had the opportunity to say the things I wanted to say. Some people don't get that opportunity. And the hardest thing that I had to do, and hospice said to do this, was to tell him that it's okay to go. I don't know if you heard me, actually. When I get really honest, I said it, but I didn't say it very loud. And he was laying there. But I can laugh now, but it wasn't a laughing matter then. But anyway, I think he did. But I was able to tell him that to release him. But anyway, he died, and I was, I can't see my watch. I got to finish. I was just devastated. I'd lost my best friend. My house filled up immediately with people, and got through the funeral, and then everybody left, and I thought, I want to die. I don't want to go on living. This is just too hard. But my program kicked in, and the one thing I had to do, and that's go to meetings. I don't care how bad it was. I always had to go to meetings. And that's a good thing to have to do. Some habits are very good. And so I kept going to meetings, and I kept just putting one foot in front of the other. And I was speaking one time, and, you know, footprints in the sand, where sometimes there's only one set of footprints, and that's when God's carrying you. Well, I was talking one night in Milledgeville, and I said, and you know what? I was saying that about the footprints, and I said, and God's been carrying me because I just couldn't make it on my own. But I said, he's put me down, and I wish he'd pick me back up. But I realized today what he does carry us when we can't go, but he puts us down, and he lets us hold your hands, and you help us walk through whatever it is we have to walk through. Anyway, So I'm going along and just doing what I have to do. I have to work, make a living, and I have to go to meetings, you know, and I've got family and I've got Al-Anon and AA support, and I'm making it one day at a time. Well, 1 year after he died, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I thought, good, I can go on and be with him. Now, that's not your normal reaction to cancer, but that's where I was at the time. But God was not through with me yet, and I survived the cancer and kept going. Kept working, kept going to meetings, kept doing service work, kept going. The year after I had breast cancer, 2 years after Rip died, I got a call from that first husband's sister. And she said, we found him dead at his house. He had died from alcoholism. And I had the opportunity to go back and make amends to him. He was dead. Somebody told me the best amends I ever made to that man was get off his back, which was true. But I had not, for me, I had not made amends. And so I was able to go and make amends to him after he died and go to his funeral and be there to tell his mama you did the best you could with what you had, because she was blaming herself for her son's death. And she never would get an Al-Anon. But anyway, that husband, in between the two husbands dying, had sent me a letter. And I read it at the time, and it made me angry. He was wanting me back and declaring his undying love for me. He had never remarried, but he had never quit drinking. And at the time, because I was grieving so for Rip, it just made me angry. And just the other day, a girl that I sponsor was at my house wanting to see my, she's heard my talk, she wanted to see his picture. So I had my wedding pictures from that first marriage out. Well, I found that letter, and she read it to me out loud. I said, that was the sweetest thing. I had a complete different reaction. He was so sweet, and he was a good man, and it's such a shame. He just could not get sober. He was one of those who could not make it in this program, which is such a shame. Anyway, back to me. I've learned to do things differently as life's gone on, and that was a long time ago. But I just somebody said, well, why don't you tell what you've been doing these last however many years? 15, 14 years. I said, I'm telling you. I put one foot in front of the other. I keep going to meetings. I keep trying to do the next right thing. I pray every day, and I try to help somebody else. I think John said it, which he did a great job last night, but I think he said it. We're to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man, and I'm trying to do that. I don't know how else to tell you what I'm doing. I guess everybody expects me to marry it again and all that kind of stuff, you know. Well, it just hadn't happened, and that's okay. But anyway, I do know that what gets me through is that I have all of you, and I can hold your hand, and I can walk through whatever it is, and that's God working through you to help me, and that's how it works. And I want to close with something Rip used to use that y'all will recognize, I know, and it's, I was lost in a forest, and I didn't know the way out, but this hand was extended to me. It said, Linda, you're lost in a forest. And you don't know the way out. But if you'll take my hand and hold my hand, I'll get you out of that forest. You may have felt a rougher hand, a smoother hand, a stronger hand, or a weaker hand. But you've never felt a hand that extends to you the love that this hand extends. Just walk by my side and hold my hand. We may encounter many quagmires and many stumbling stones before we get out of this forest. But see, if you'll just walk by my side and hold my hand, you may stumble, but I won't let you fall. Just as we began to get to the edge of the forest, and you can see a ray of light, please don't let go of my hand, because if you do, you'll get lost again. But when I've led you safely out of this forest, and you know the way out, then it'll be your responsibility to go back into the forest and lead another lost person out. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.